The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You live here. He lives here.
Well, my 90 has me for good now. I, like the other caller, used to listen to you on that other station.
Chris, so glad you're back on the air. You're the best in Philadelphia.
Can I just say how much I am enjoying your new show? Really good. You are loved.
I appreciate you, Chris. You're doing great, great service to Delaware Valley.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris Stegall on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Starting to sound like the DNC convention in there. Little past 6 o'clock. Telephone. We should start doing the show from a kid's library. Telephone number 610-850-0990. The number 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. It all looks like a hostage video. I said yesterday when they announced that Biden was officially the nominee, it had the look of what you ever seen when they release people from therapy or rehab sessions and they get to they have a little party in the lobby or ring a bell. It looked like they let Joe out of a rehab facility. I mean, like, you know, when they send old people to, you know, rehabilitate after they've had a surgery. I don't mean a clinic. That's his son Hunter, maybe, but Joe Biden, I don't know that's had any kind of substance abuse. So, no, this is more like when you send an old person to a nursing home or a therapeutics place, you know, and they've been there working on their hip or something after they had it replaced. Then they fire off these little confetti cannons, and you have to do the fake surprise thing. Is there anything worse than watching somebody pretend to be surprised about something they know is coming? That's the most painful thing to watch. Anyway, hey, good morning, folks. Middle of the week already. Flying by. Telephone number 610-850-0990. The number 610-850-0990. And we're online at 990theanswer.com. Hope you download our app. Take us along with you and listen wherever you are for free. Jill Biden spoke last night in a classroom. Now, what the hell was Jill Biden doing in an American classroom? That place isn't safe for man nor beast. The symbolism of Jill Biden standing in a classroom, imagine that. No one's allowed to set foot in the classroom. We'll all die. What is she doing? That's like, she may as well go stand in the middle of a nuclear waste dump. You can't be in a... I bet the teachers' unions were furious to see Jill Biden in a classroom reminding people of what it used to be a kid, sending your kids to in-school, in-person learning. And then I guess what? They moved to the library of the school? This was all happening in Wilmington. What school was this? Do we know?
She said a Brandywine.
Okay. So yeah. Is that the Delaware flag over her shoulder? It was in Wilmington. Am I right about that? They don't cross state lines. Delaware... You've seen Delaware. Poor Delaware is now on New York's travel ban list. I don't know if it's still on New Jersey's or not. Did Murphy remove? Poor Delaware. This is hilarious. It's actually sort of ironic in a way. Northeastern states, who were all supposedly part of this confab, you know, the League of Unimpressive Gentlemen. 9 states, and Delaware was one of them, along with Pennsylvania and New York and Connecticut, to name a few. I think Rhode Island, Massachusetts. They all got together and said, we're smarter than the rest of the country. The 9 of us are going to put our heads together and come up with a plan. I'll head it, says Cuomo, the old person killer. And within weeks, really, I guess the League of Unimpressive Gentlemen dissolved. Carney, the governor of Delaware, he keeps winding up on other unimpressive gentlemen's list of travel ban states. I don't know what the hell Carney in Delaware did to the rest of the league. Must not have paid his dues or something. They keep putting him on a list of people that can't come into a state without quarantine. Made Carney mad a couple of weeks ago, remember?
You're right. Brandywine High School is in Wilmington.
Okay. That's good. That's good, because if Biden left, he'd have to quarantine now. And apparently, that's the irony. If Biden never did actually come out of the basement, he'd have to... Like, he couldn't go to New York or anywhere else. They'd make him. And is John Kerry looking more and more like Fred Gwynn every day? For you kids, that's a reference to an old sitcom, The Munsters. He was also the judge in My Cousin Vinny for you Gen Xers. Utes. The guy, I've never met or seen, well, I've not met John Kerry. I've never seen a man who seems to be somehow elongating. And it's like Stretch Armstrong. As he ages, it's like droopy. He just gets long. His face and jawline gets longer and longer. His body gets more narrow. It was an all-star cavalcade last night of Iraq war hawks. It's extraordinary. Colin Powell, General Colin Powell was trotted out there. So was Cindy McCain. Night number two of Joe Biden's basically a Republican. I thought, aren't these the people that gave us Bush lied, people died? Aren't these the people that sent our men and women? Our blood and treasure was spilled and wasted in Iraq. These are the people, the people who were directly tied to those decisions. By the way, including Joe Biden. These people were directly tied to the decisions that George W. Bush came under withering attack over for the rest of his career. And still to this day, Bush lied. Excuse me. Bush lied. People died. Blood for oil. Halliburton. Cheney. Remember all that? Now they're all speaking on behalf of the Democrat nominee. It's taken less than 20 years, and everybody that was once accused on the Republican side of falsifying WMD, falsifying a record of mass carnage, destruction, and death by Saddam Hussein just as an excuse to invade a country, that party, the Republican Party, is now on the stage with Joe Biden endorsing him. Someone's going to have to explain that to me. Cindy McCain. John Kasich. Colin Powell. Ugh. Well, at any rate, he gets the nomination formally last night. They pipe in. I don't quite know. I didn't actually see this moment. I saw it this morning. The moment where he actually gets the nomination and they fire the confetti cannon behind him and Jill. What are the other people? Did you watch this? Did you see any of it, Fast Eddie, even this morning?
Just some of it this morning, yeah.
Who are the people that are like applauding around him like relatives?
I would think maybe his grandchildren.
I don't mean in the room.
Oh.
I mean Zoom conferenced in. So remember, everything's digital. Nobody's in person. So everything that you're watching at this thing last night, folks, I can't stay up to watch this stuff. And I wouldn't, I don't think I would even if I could, to be very honest with you. But I mean, when it starts at 10 o'clock, I'm like, no, I'm not going to stay up till midnight just in case I miss Cindy McCain saying something juicy. And I never, by the way, miss anything. You know, between Fast Eddie and I, we've got our sharp eye on it anyway, and we'll let you hear some of it. We got it. I mean, Clinton, yeah, I know, and AOC got her 60 seconds. Hey, even The Onion made fun of last night with AOC. I shared this on Instagram. Here's their, The Onion is the, you know, the fake news, it's a, you know, comedy website. Here's the headline. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez upgraded to full DNC speaking slot after announcing support for Iraq war. So The Onion is a left-leaning comedy site, all right? They write fake headlines, and whenever they write political headlines, it's almost always to skewer Republicans. They're lefties at The Onion. Funny, but they're lefties. That's their editorial comment confirming exactly what I just said. Left-wingers are watching this thing. This is what I'm saying. I said it yesterday. Kasich is one of the leadoff hitters. The week of the DNC, the former Republican governor of Ohio is one of their starters. And what does he say? Hey, everybody, John Kasich in giant pants with a multicolored belt here in a field to tell you, don't you worry about Joe Biden going too hard left. I know Joe Biden well. I've known him for a long time, and I bet there are a lot of you watching worried that Joe Biden's going to go too hard left, that he's too close to the radical fringe left. Well, I know Joe Biden, and by golly, I, John Kasich, in giant pants and a multicolored belt in the middle of a field, am here to tell you Joe Biden's never going to go too hard left. So you people on the Republican side who don't like Trump, and you want to feel good about your vote this fall, trust me, John Kasich in these giant pants with the multicolored belt. Trust me when I tell you, Joe Biden's basically a Republican. That's how the Democrat convention started! It doesn't even make any sense! And so these lefties like AOC and others are watching it going, what in the hell are we doing? What have we been working for? Bernie comes on a little later that night and says, hey, everything John Kasich said is I'm the opposite. I'm crazy, and I thank God that the party's gone crazy, and I've dragged Joe Biden successfully to crazy with me. Like, it completely negated everything John Kasich just said in the same night. AOC last night, she's out there snarking and grousing that people like Kasich keep dismissing her, saying, oh, no, Joe Biden's not crazy like AOC. Don't sweat it. And she said, oh, really? I've told you before, the greatest benefit to the AOCs and the hard left of the Democrat Party is what? What's the greatest possible outcome this fall if you're Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Remember what I said about this? Greatest possible outcome for AOC. Now, think personally about the AOC brand. I want you to think like a politician. Think of yourself. Think of furthering yourself. Think of self-promotion, opportunity to rise and raise your profile within the party. What's the greatest thing that could happen to her this fall?
If Trump wins, that creates four more years of this kind of media coverage, and she will rise in the party.
That's exactly right. And she will officially have the mantle of authority, because what she will be able to say when this is over, if Joe Biden loses this thing, is, you see, you cannot continue to play footsie with guys in farm fields and giant pants and multicolored belts. You can't bring in Meg Whitman and Christine Todd Whitman and Cindy McCain. You can't bring in a bunch of Republicans to our Democrat convention to try to assure non-Democrats it's safe to vote for Republic. It's safe for them to leave their party or their affiliation and vote for Democrats. That's not the way forward for the Democrat Party, AOC could effectively say. She would say, you want excitement, you want enthusiasm, you want a robust party where people go out and vote not just against someone but for something? Well, that's what Bernie had. And it's not arguable, actually. Look, it's frightening. I don't want it. And to be very clear, it's a short-sighted thought on my behalf when I say I'd love nothing more than to see that happen this year. In 4 years, it portends something very problematic, depending on who the Republican nominee is. This 4 years was over in a blink. Well, until this year. This year will go on for the rest of our lives. But up until this year, I mean, the first 3 years of Donald Trump's presidency, it was like a blink. And so, you know, Donald Trump gets a second term, and here's what's waiting at the end of Donald Trump's second term. That woman, and Bernie if he's still alive, or a Bernie surrogate. At the end of a second Donald Trump term are these people who will now say, I'm not, let me tell you something, there's a new boss. There's a new sheriff in town, and it ain't Sloppy Choppers, and it ain't Joe Biden, and it ain't Hillary Clinton, and it ain't Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, that's another one. Bill Clinton is speaking in night number two. A guy who on the very day he's set to speak, the Daily Mail publishes a piece. Hey, look at these photos we found of him getting a shoulder rub from the girl that Jeffrey Epstein captured when she was a minor and sold her off to sex. Whoops! People said to me yesterday, Chris, I don't understand what the big deal is. I mean, the picture of Bill Clinton getting the massage from the girl, she's 22. She's a massage therapist. That's not the point at all! That's not the point. Yes, it's legal, and she was an adult and all of that. That's not the point. The point is she is now officially one of Jeffrey Epstein's minor captives at his sex island. I don't care that she's 22 giving Bill Clinton a massage. And by the way, I'll bet you Hillary doesn't care that she's 22, assuming Hillary ever cared. I'm still not convinced those two have ever shared a room. I'll never quite figure out what it is, but I don't really believe there's anything going on there. I don't even think they live in the same house. I think they're like old people who live in, you know, if they're in the same house, they're definitely in separate rooms. You think they're sharing a bed? Honestly, do you think Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton share a bed?
No.
Of course they don't. If they're ever in the same house, which I doubt is ever. But anyway, you know, like if my wife saw a photo surface of me getting a massage from a 22-year-old girl who's been in the news as someone sold for underage sex, I don't think her reaction would be, well, I mean, she technically in that picture is of legal age and I understand was sort of into massage therapy, so I guess that's on the level, Chris. I don't have a problem with this photo. Like, no! That's what people were trying to tell me yesterday. What's the big deal? It's Jeffrey Epstein's pedophile island. That's the girl, like the star of the island, when she was 12. Now he's getting a familiar 22-year-old massage from her? Like, that's on the night he's scheduled to speak. Think of what this party is saying. Think of what they're presenting.
Wait, this happened before he went on?
Yes, yesterday. This story, right after our show was over, yesterday morning, I think it was probably about 11 o'clock or so, the Daily Mail publishes a story with new pictures of Clinton getting a rubdown from the 22-year-old. Check it. I put it up on Facebook. You can check the story. You can check the pictures. I posted it yesterday. I shared it on all my social media and said, gosh, I hope Bill Clinton's just, you know, I hope he's loose for tonight. Of course, all this is pre-taped. That's another part of this. I feel insane. I feel like I'm watching the biggest disaster for the Democrats that I've ever watched. This is a disaster. I don't know who put this together, but if you're trying to inspire people on your side to turn out and vote for Joe, and most of your show now is dedicated, two nights now have been dedicated to trying to convince non-Democrats why they ought to be comfortable voting for Joe Biden. Now, do you think that's what the crowd tearing down statues and looting and burning stores wants to be watching and hearing? Hell no! They want that angry stuff that Michelle Obama was selling. She's the only one that brought the goods. Anyway, more on this. Telephone number 610-850-0990. This is really sort of, well, why shouldn't it be? 2020's been bizarre. Why should it stop now? 620 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
I have always loved the sounds of a classroom. The quiet that sparks with possibility just before students shuffle in. The murmur of ideas bouncing back and forth as we explore the world together. The laughter and tiny moments of surprise you find in materials you've taught a million times.
You know, I really, all kidding aside, she seems like a lovely woman. I have no qualms with Jill Biden. I don't know anything about Jill Biden. I'm sure she's a lovely, fine person. And this is a lovely speech, and it's warm, and it's nice. It's the antithesis, by the way, of Michelle Obama. I mean, the nasty, hateful, kind of just divisive dystopia that Michelle Obama paints on night number one. It's like Jill Biden shows up, and she's a nice lady. You know, and it's like, good for her. I have no fight with Jill Biden. However, I will say, her opening her speech, standing in a classroom, telling everybody how wonderful being in a classroom is. I don't know. Like, if there were people watching this last night, who have children, and they're thinking to themselves, yeah, Jill, we know. And unfortunately, your party and the members of your party who govern states like Pennsylvania and Delaware and New Jersey won't let us be in that warm, wonderful place where laughter and the exchange of ideas can happen. We're all locked in our homes, Jill. Again, I'm not quibbling with Jill Biden, just saying the reminder how much she loves the classroom and what warm, wonderful things happen in the classroom. We all know, and thanks for the reminder, none of us are allowed to be in it because there's an election coming and your husband needs to win. And people like the governor of Pennsylvania and New Jersey have decided that the best way to be helpful is to keep kids locked up in their house.
When I taught English here at Brandywine High School, I would spend my summer preparing for the school year about to start, filled with anticipation. But this quiet is heavy. You can hear the anxiety that echoes down empty hallways. There's no scent of new notebooks or freshly waxed.
Can you hear anxiety when there's no one there? It's an odd turn of phrase. You can hear the anxiety in the empty hallways. Is that what she said? Did I hear that right?
Yeah.
You can hear the anxiety. Okay.
Next floors. The rooms are dark as the bright young faces that should fill them are now confined to boxes on a computer screen.
Yeah, we know.
I hear it from so many of you.
That we'd like to go back to school and send our kids back?
The frustration of parents juggling work while they support their children's learning.
Yes, I'm glad you're hearing it. Why does your husband and your party continue to insist it stay that way?
Are afraid that their kids might get sick from school.
No one sane who's been paying attention to medicine thinks that, Jill. Dr. Jill. No one sane who's been paying attention to medicine thinks their kids are going to get sick. In fact, if you look at the arguments for not opening school, not a one of them ever will you find people talking about the safety of the children. Never, ever. It's never, ever been about the safety of the children.
The concern of every person working without enough protection. The despair in the lines that stretch out before food banks.
Right.
And the indescribable sorrow that follows every lonely last breath when the ventilators turn off. As a mother and a grandmother, as an American,
yeah,
I am heartbroken by the magnitude of this loss, by the failure to protect our communities, by every precious and irreplaceable life gone.
First of all, how many people are on the ventilator? I mean, forget it. It's not even worth going into. Telephone number 610-850-0990. Let's go to Keith to kick us off this morning. Hey. Keith, I'm glad you called. Hi.
Hey, how you doing today, Chris?
Doing well,
hey,
sir.
You know, with all these different people making appearances, I just got visions in my head of like Woodstock and all these different acts coming up. We should just call the convention Bidenstock 2020.
That's right. No, isn't it bizarre that they're bringing up all these old Republicans? What do you
think? There aren't enough old Democrats, I guess. I don't know.
No, but honestly, how do you take that? Are you a Republican voter? Are you registered Republican?
Yeah, yes, I am.
Always have been?
Always. No. I was a Democrat up until, and I'll have to test your memory on this, when Bill Clinton was president, he fought against Congress changing the welfare to work. He kept putting the kibosh on that, didn't want to sign that legislation. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm out here working. Why are you not making other people go out and work? Why are you making it still easy for people? I'm not saying people shouldn't have help if they need help. Don't misunderstand me. But, you know, it just seemed like he was doing everything he could to drag that out. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what, I got to make a change because this isn't the party for me. And of course, this was all right when I first bought my house. And all of a sudden, funny thing, what happens when you buy a house, you got a lot of bills. I went from my parents' house to my house. I got bills, I'm paying taxes now, and you pay a little more attention to your checkbook. And I said, this isn't for me. So I got to make a change.
Bill Clinton turned you into a Republican.
Yes.
Interesting. That was also in the era of Newt Gingrich. All right, and so you never voted for another Democrat for president after that?
Nope.
Yeah, so what did you make of these Democrats? I mean, if you can get into their mind for a minute, what do you think this works as a strategy? Cindy McCain, Colin Powell, John Kasich, Meg Whitman, Christine Todd Whitman, these Republican-ish people showing up at this convention trying to convince people, I assume maybe like you, who once voted Democrat, hey, it's okay. Joe's not like AOC. Joe isn't. Assuming you find AOC unpalatable, do you think they're making the sale that Biden's not the left-winger that some might be concerned he is?
I'll be honest. I just don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. I really don't.
No, I mean, do you think it, just personally, do you think it works? Do you buy it?
I don't buy it.
Yeah. Do you?
I think there's a very small, both parties have to placate to a very small percentage of voters. You're either going to vote for Biden or you're going to vote for Trump. And there's that fine little line in the middle. And that's what both sides are trying to get. And
do you know anybody like that?
No, not really.
You married?
Not really, but again, no.
Okay, not married. So do you, any women in your life that you're close to, friends with?
Yeah.
Yeah. Women, they say women don't like Trump. That women has trouble women have trouble with Trump, and that, you know, maybe Biden could make the sale there, but they got to women have got to be convinced Biden's not a lunatic, like some of the Democrat Party, and so maybe that's what this show is. It's for them.
I don't know, but we talked before. You know, I'm a truck driver, and I see an awful lot of Trump signs all over this country,
yeah,
all over the place. So I don't know when I see the people have them on their cars, Trump flags, and I can't remember the last time I saw Biden anything.
I drove through one neighborhood a couple of weeks ago. I remember where my wife and I were going, but we ended up driving through some kind of neighborhood adjacent to where we were supposed to be. And we turned down one street. It was hilarious. There was a Biden sign in the neighbor in one neighbor's yard, and literally right next door, Trump sign. Right next door, Biden sign. Right next door, Trump sign. Four houses in a row, Biden, Trump, Biden, Trump. On one street, side by side. And I thought, boy, this must be a fun street. And they had their signs obnoxiously placed in the corner of each lawn, right? Like, so the corner that buttressed the lawn next to them, they had it kind of obnoxious, like the Mason-Dixon line, right? Like, they stuck it there in the kind of the parkway area of the lawn, right on the edge of the property, buttressing the opposing view's lawn. I was like, oh, this is like civil war here. I have seen a couple of Biden signs, but yeah, anecdotally, mostly Trump. That's true. Look, the point is, what I was talking about with Keith, you ladies are the ones that are going to make the difference here. I mean, let's just be completely candid about it. It ain't the men. I'm sorry, I don't know how else to say it. And people have been kind of beating around the bush about it, but I'll just come out and say it. This is not an election for the men. This is an election for the women. Ratification of the 19th Amendment yesterday, by the way. 100 years. Ladies have been given the right to vote. Republicans, by the way, with Republican support, like every other meaningful reform in American history, the Republicans led the charge and supported it while the Democrats opposed it. Woodrow Wilson, Democrat, and the Democrats, the majority of Democrats in Congress opposed it. It was the Republicans that supported women having the right to vote and making it a constitutional amendment, much like freeing the slaves and the Civil Rights Amendment. In every meaningful historic moment for the American people that bestowed equal rights to the American people, it was the Republican Party that led the way and led the charge when the Democrats opposed it. Every time, it's history, it's a fact, look it up. But this election is for you women. As we're told, women are scared of Trump. Women find Trump vulgar. Women are turned off by Trump. And Jill Biden standing in the classroom, brokenhearted and crestfallen, telling everybody how sad she is that everyone's so afraid of school. That plays. Johnny Pancakes with his giant pants and multicolored belt in the farm field standing in the middle of gravel. That, you ladies, that's for you. Cindy McCain, that's for you ladies. Joe Biden's not like AOC, don't sweat it. Joe Biden's not radical, don't sweat it. It's all right, ladies. It's seriously, I'm not kidding. You think I'm kidding? It's all for you. There aren't any men out there going, I wonder how to vote this fall. And I'm not, of course, I hope you understand. I'm not talking specifically about you ladies in this audience. I'm talking about ladies generally. 610-850-0990 if you see it differently. I don't know how you do. Those of you who are with us here early this morning, you might not have been able to hang around and catch Donald Trump Jr., who visited with us late in the show yesterday. We're going to let you hear that conversation next.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. This is Dennis Prager, middays 1 to 3. Grab a cup of coffee for the ride in. You're listening to Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle.
To have back with us Donald Trump Jr. Mr. Trump, pleasure to have you back on the show, sir. Good morning.
Good to be back with you. How you guys doing?
Well, we're doing well. I was just talking about a registered Democrat friend of mine who said, I've just had it. I've had it with Cuomo lying on television about how poorly the response from President Trump was during COVID. I mean, he's on. You guys have a great video strung together of these Democrat governors. We just played it, singing his praises.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing, the revisionist history. And Andrew Cuomo talking about a response to COVID as though he had some sort of great success in New York is truly amazing. It's like jumping up on the podium, cracking the champagne when you're number 50 out of 50, and not in a good way. He's killed more people with his executive order, putting old people back into nursing homes. The one thing that literally everyone in America knew about COVID-19 was that if you were old, or if you had pre-existing conditions, both of which are pretty prevalent in nursing homes, it's a really bad thing. He sticks them back in there. 6,000 people, I believe, were dead because of his decision-making, and yet the media will laud him as this great leader during the time of COVID, I guess because he'll talk smack about Trump, on TV, and that's what they want. I mean, guys like even Gavin Newsom, at least he was honest about it. Gavin Newsom, obviously, very different politics in California. They're in 40-something lawsuits with the administration over other things. But, like, even he said, hey, listen, if I needed something, it was there the next day. I'd call Donald Trump at midnight. It was there. He got it for us done. So at least some people are willing and able to be honest. Others will lie on camera to get the attention. Obviously, he's trying to set up his 2024 bid. But when you have the disastrous response that New York did, other than the media spawning all over him, for a total and complete failure, it's pretty pathetic and it's pretty sad and it should disgust some people.
Don, I meant to say off the top, and I should have started with this, but allow me to say before we go any further, I was terribly, terribly sorry and saddened to learn of your uncle's passing over the weekend. I read the president's response to it. He called him his best friend. It broke my heart for him. We all pray for you and your family. I'm so sorry to see the loathsome things that were said in social media. I know that that's not your first rodeo with it, but I'm terribly sorry for what the family's going through.
Unfortunately, we've gotten used to some of that response, but when you see wrong Trump trending about 5 minutes after a loved one dies, it's pretty disgusting. It shows you how deranged they are. For the party of supposed tolerance, they're not so tolerant at all. They're actually the most intolerant people in the world. They're only tolerant if you go along with their nonsense. Hook, line, and sinker, meaning you're not allowed to deviate even a little bit. You got to be 100% on board or you're the enemy, and you can see that in all of their actions.
I saw you on one of these boats with Kimberly Guilfoyle over the weekend, one of the Trump boat parades. Where was that? These things are popping up all over on both coasts.
Amazingly enough, that was in Montauk, New York. I mean, people from all over Long Island, not exactly a Republican stronghold came out. There are hundreds of boats. I mean, and it wasn't just, guys on sport fishing boats. I mean, guys were showing up in paddle boards and kayaks, and the commercial fishing, crews and vessels were coming in and joining in, all of them flying Trump flags. It was sort of amazing. So there's a lot of that sort of support. It's that same person who's probably not telling a pollster who they're actually voting for. But man, they're showing up and they're going to get it done.
The president seemed to suggest, I don't know if it was serious. I don't mean to imply he doesn't mean it, but did he suggest, did I hear correctly, that he wants to make a play, or it was at least messaging to make a play for New York State?
Well, listen, I think there's a lot of aspects that people forget about. Places like New York State, there's going to be four or five congressional seats that we can pick up. Same with California, right? I'm not sure that you win the overall. But the reality is you don't want to just win the presidency. You got to win a lot of those congressional seats, because if you have Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, you're going to see more of the nonsense that you get done. So if you want the Trump agenda, you got to get the House. You got to keep the Senate. And you got to fight for all of those things, because the president by himself can't do it. So, you know, you see a lot of that. I spend a lot of my time in upstate. It's sort of, you know, where I go and get away. I'm on the New York, Pennsylvania border in upstate. And, you know, man, if I go to a restaurant, I'm getting high fives all over the place. It's very different than New York City. And it's more so than it was even in 16, because the difference is now you have 4 years of a track record of success and accomplishment fighting for the American people. In 16, you know, Trump was like every other politician, making promises that no one was sure if he'd ever be able to deliver on them. Now that he has, I think there's a lot more demand.
Donald Trump Jr. on the phone with us. I'm curious if you think the public safety issue is number one, or if you think coronavirus ultimately ends up being the driver, whether we want it to be or not, heading into the final stretch of this campaign. What's the number one?
I think they're both factors. I think the media is definitely overplaying the coronavirus one. I mean, it's a very serious thing. You got to take it seriously. But, like, the reality is that's something that came from China. China lied about it. They manipulated the World Health Organization. They gave faulty statistics. They shut down travel from Wuhan to Beijing and to Shanghai, while allowing it to go to Milan, allowing people to continue to go to New York, to California. I mean, China brought this on. Who's going to be tough on China? Beijing Biden, whose son took $1.5 billion, which roughly translates to about $30 million a year in fees from the Chinese government. The guy, Beijing Biden, who literally built China, pushed for them for permanent status in the World Trade Organization, which allowed them to grow from an economy that was the size of the Netherlands to the economy that it is today. You think he's going to be tough on China, or you think Donald Trump, the guy that actually put sanctions, fought and got a trade deal done with them after utilizing tariffs and utilizing the might of the American economy? Joe Biden wouldn't even know how to do that if he wanted to. He's just been a 50-year D.C. swamp creature. 50 years. You tell me that Joe Biden's going to fix things now? He's been in Washington, D.C. for 50 years. Now he's magically going to fix things. Now he's going to come and do it. I mean, Joe, what were you doing for the first half a century?
Right.
The reality is this, because if Joe Biden knew how to fix anything, he should have probably told Obama.
Don, I watched with actual great fascination, and I wonder what the campaign, what you guys think when you see, with the aid of the media, within quite literally 48 hours, I've never seen anything quite like it, a wholly manufactured post office scandal. And I mean, on a dime it happened. From Friday to Sunday, it was out of thin air to Pelosi calling everybody back to Congress to deal with the emergency of the post office. Does that boggle you, or are you no longer impressed or surprised with what they do?
I mean, I lived through 4 years of Russia hoax. I watched them try to throw me in jail for treason, apparently. I mean, there's nothing that they won't do. I've seen what they did to Brett Kavanaugh. I saw what they tried to do to Nick Sandman and the Covington Catholic kids. There's nothing they won't destroy. And the media is just the DNC, voice box, right? They're not journalists anymore. There's not even a pretense of objectivity anymore. They don't even pretend. They are just left-wing activists. So, the story of the post office thing is the biggest nonsense ever. My father literally is on the right. Like, hey, I'll fund them, but I want to fund them as part of an overall package. I don't want to just give the Democrats their wish list while getting nothing for the American people. So he says, I'll fund them, but it's got to be as part of a package where we're giving stimulus back to Americans who need it, who need that money, who've lost their jobs, whose, liberal governors are saying, you can't go to work, you can't go to church, you can't go to school, you can't do anything unless you want to riot. If you want to riot and you want to loot and you want to steal, you can do that. You can do that in large crowds. You don't need to socially distance. You don't need to wear a mask. And you're obviously totally exempt from COVID and legal consequence. You're totally exempt from both of those things. That's the Democrat Party today. So nothing surprises me at this point with the amount of garbage that they'll make up to try to sway an election, because the Democrats and the media are just one in the same at this point.
What do you make of John Kasich, Meg Whitman, and some other Republicans speaking at the Democrats event this week?
Let's be clear. The supposed Republicans, Meg Whitman, the other Whitman, the lobbyists for Google and Russia that are, they were conservatives. I mean, these are the people that the Democrats are trying to sell to the Americans. These are Republicans. Oh, my God. Look, they're going against. These aren't Republicans. They weren't Republicans when they were running as Republicans. They were Republican in New Jersey and in California. They were basically liberals in any other state. It's just asinine. But again, the media will say, look, Trump has lost Republicans. It's like, I don't think anyone's considering these people even remotely Republicans, certainly not Meg Whitman.
No.
And it's laughable that the media will, again, like they're trying to sell to the American people that Joe Biden is a moderate. You know, he's a moderate guy from Scranton, PA. You know, he left when he was 7 years old, but that's him. Joe Biden's not a moderate. He's not an outsider. He's not a blue-collar guy. Joe Biden's a D.C. swamp creature. He's been there for half a century. Like, stop.
Your father has been clear. He'll have any debate anywhere, anytime. He wants to do one now, and he wants to do more. Will Biden even do three? Are you anticipating he might not even commit to the three?
They've committed to the three. I don't anticipate him going through with it. Like, you see it. The New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, they're all starting to, you know what? Debates were good for the Democrat thing, you know, the Democrat Party nomination a couple of weeks ago. But aren't debates sort of obsolete at this point? Aren't they sort of, you know, we should just cancel the debates. I mean, these are, like, supposedly credible institutions basically saying, hey, we know that Joe Biden cannot be on the stage with Donald Trump. Now, if Joe Biden does show up, which I'd be surprised, if Joe Biden does show up and he doesn't, like, collapse, meaning if he gets out, like, one of his half sentences where it's, like, there's almost a complete thought there, but not quite. They'll be like, the media will be like, oh, Joe Biden won. He did wonderful. You know, I'm sure there's some sort of medical drug that they can give him to make him a little bit lucid for, like, the hour that they're going to be on the stage together. You know, I'm sure there's something that they'll give him because there's no way he can go in on a regular day.
Maybe hydroxychloroquine.
He can't remember where he is.
Yeah, maybe hydroxychloroquine, Don. I don't know. Maybe they'll give him that.
Yeah, maybe.
Hey, listen, last question. I know you got to run. The Durham investigation, are you guys hopeful or will you be telling the story of Obamagate? Is that too confusing to tell the American people at this hour? Where do you stand with that in terms of messaging?
It seems very simple, but you see the Democrat push. This can't come out now. It's before an election. I go, wait a second. The administration that did this to us, that held this over our heads for 4 years, Joe Biden was part of that administration. Joe Biden unmasked me in some of these dealings 8 days before the inauguration, before the supposed peaceful transition of power was supposed to happen. So they do that. They call my father an agent of Russia. They hold that over your head for 4 years, and then they're supposed to be able to run without people actually knowing. I mean, they did that to us in midterms where Mueller knew exactly that there was nothing wrong, but he didn't do it till after the midterm election so he could hold that cloud over our heads. I mean, the fact that they would say that this shouldn't come out before the election because it could bias the election tells you all you need to know about Trump derangement syndrome in Washington, D.C. The reality is that the very people that we are now running against were the people that perpetrated that hoax, and Americans should know that more than anything before they vote in November.
I can't wait. I know it's going to come up in the debates, and so do they. I can't wait to see how it's dealt with. Donald Trump Jr., I know Pennsylvania is near and dear to your heart, not just the campaign. You're a landowner here. I know you guys come through here a lot, and I know we'll hear from you more before the closing days of the campaign. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks so much, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Thank you to all our delegations. I'm pleased to announce that Vice President Joe Biden has officially been nominated by the Democratic Party as our candidate for President of the United States.
Oh, to cool in the gang, no less. It's really hipping it up in there.
You live here. He lives here.
Hey, Chris, thanks for being there and everything you do on a daily basis. We really appreciate it.
Chris, I agree with your other callers. You are a godsend.
You have a mixture of sense of humor, intelligence, and godliness. You are the answer.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Well, in the midst of all the chaos from city to city, as we see all over the country, and sadly, Philadelphia is not excluded, not exempt, maybe not as violent as some other cities have been, but to the extent that it has been, and there are a lot of, I mean, we talked about on Monday's radio show in Philadelphia, something like 34 shootings, and on the front page of the Inquirer was the post office. So who's going to step in and do something about it? I'll tell you one guy, Bill McSwain, who is the United States Attorney for the Southeastern region of Pennsylvania, and he joins us again. Mr. McSwain, it's great to have you on. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Chris. My pleasure.
This is, you know, something that everybody's been wondering about. We've talked about before, you know, the federal response to the extent that there should be one from the president in cities, you know, where federal, you know, installations have been attacked or whatnot. You know, it doesn't always require the president to step in, but what role do you see yours being in the violence going on in major cities like Philadelphia?
Well, the U.S. Attorney's Office definitely has an important traditional role to deal with violent crime wherever it occurs. And that's something that we've consistently done as federal prosecutors, but the current situation, I think, requires even more attention. I mean, certainly, I would describe what's the city is experiencing right now as an emergency. I mean, just this past weekend, over 20 people were shot. 2 weekends ago, over 25 people were shot in the city, including 6 at a playground, which is very disturbing. Over 100 children have been shot so far in 2020. And if we keep on the pace that we're at now, we're going to have over 400 homicides this year. And we were in the 200s before you know, the current district attorney arrived. And probably the most heartbreaking victim in all this, Zamar Jones, a 7-year-old, was playing on his front porch in West Philadelphia, was shot in the head and murdered. Incidentally, murdered by, or allegedly murdered by, an individual, Michael Banks, who should have been in jail, but wasn't, because the DA's office dropped the felony gun charge, moved it down to a misdemeanor in 2019 for no apparent reason. So it's not hard to figure out, I think, why this carnage is occurring. We need a strong law enforcement response, and the weak law enforcement response we've had from the local prosecutors has greatly contributed to this emergency. So the federal government, in the form of the U.S. Attorney's Office and our federal partners, are stepping in and trying to do everything we can to get this turned around.
Mr. McSwain, if people are listening in any part of the country where violence is prevalent, any major city, Chicago, have you talked with colleagues of yours in other U.S. attorney's offices? Are they stepping into the fold in a similar way that you are in the Philadelphia region?
Yes, I have frequent and ongoing conversations with my colleagues, my brothers and sisters who are U.S. attorneys throughout the country. And a lot of the urban areas are experiencing similar problems. There has been an alarming uptick in violence, certainly in the last couple months, in some of the larger cities around the country. But there are some differences, of course, city to city. We have not had the kind of federal surge that has existed in other cities where D.C. has focused on providing more agents and more resources to particular cities, and this is all coming under the umbrella of something called Operation Legend. And so some of the cities around the country have been given additional resources. We have not been on that list in Philadelphia, and I don't think that we're necessarily going to be on it in the future. If we were, I would certainly welcome the additional help. But this would be in the form of additional agents and additional resources, different federal agents coming in to do a traditional law enforcement approach to trying to prevent and solve crimes. We're not talking about you know, agents in riot gear who are surrounding the courthouse, nothing like that, but instead getting more boots on the ground to try to prevent and solve some of the homicides and some of the shootings and the violent crime that's going on.
Yeah, I know there is not a one-size-fits-all diagnosis, but what we see going on in Portland, for instance, is different than Chicago, is different than Philadelphia. I mean, is that right? They're all a little unique in their own way?
Yes, that is different. In Portland, you had a situation where the federal courthouse was essentially under attack and you know, under nightly attack. And so agents from Department of Homeland Security primarily were there to try to secure the courthouse. That's different from, for example, in Chicago. Chicago received some additional resources in the form of additional agents to try to help with the traditional law enforcement problem of getting the homicides and the shootings down. And in Philadelphia, we've had neither. We've been relying on our existing resources, but I have a lot of autonomy, certainly in the U.S. Attorney's Office, to to direct resources where I think the problems exist. And so we've directed more resources into dealing with the violent crime problem district-wide, but more specifically occurring in Philadelphia.
This was a clip from 6ABC, local news channel in Philadelphia. It was related to the gun violence, and it just caught my attention just as a public interest matter, and I wanted to get your reaction to it if I could.
Castro here with an update on the story that I'm working on today. Today I'm talking about how city leaders are coming together with other community groups and the Philadelphia Police Department to combat gun violence. The city is seeing an increase in shootings. So city leaders are distributing this flyer, which reads, "Save a life, turn in a gun." If you safely turn in a gun, that can help get it out of the hands of the wrong people. We're going to have a lot more information coming up on Action News.
Yeah, if you safely turn in a gun, that'll help it keep from getting in the hands of the wrong person. A city-driven, city leader initiative, turn in the guns. I guess I don't mean to laugh. Is that going to work?
Well, there should be a multi-pronged approach to this problem. If the city leaders want to try that, they can try it. I have my doubts that criminals who normally obtain their guns illegally and have their guns illegally, because if you're a convicted felon under federal law, you're not allowed to possess a firearm. I have my doubts that they're going to be rushing to turn in their guns. But more importantly, the prong that I can focus on the most, and the prong that I think that is the most effective, is to have a strong law enforcement response, which gives the message to the community and gives the message to potential criminals that there's going to be accountability and there's going to be consequences if you pull the trigger in Philadelphia. And right now they're not getting that message from the local prosecution authorities, but they're getting that message from us. And one of the things that we're doing, I think you're aware of this public campaign that we have going on right now, we've launched in the last couple months, where we're getting our message out by every means possible. Billboards, bus shelter advertisements, posters throughout the city, TV, radio, internet, social media. We are getting the message out that if we have federal jurisdiction over your case and we take your case, there are going to be consequences and you're going to be in big trouble. They're not getting that message from the locals, but we're hoping that our message will be a deterrent and will have an effect so that we can get the violent crime numbers moving in the right direction. Because right now, they're all going in the wrong direction, and I see a lack of will among some city leaders to really go at the heart of the problem. There's almost this feeling of inevitability, you know, is the way the DA puts it. You know, poverty equals bullets is one of his favorite phrases, which I completely disagree with. I think it's a slap in the face to law-abiding, low-income residents in the city, and also gives the wrong message to potential criminals, which essentially says, you know what, it's not your fault. You're kind of a victim in all this, too. You're poor, so it's okay if you pull the trigger. That is absolutely the wrong message. And so what I'm focusing on is a strong law enforcement response, which I think is the most effective way to reduce violent crime.
What is it supposed to be? If I have a firearm, an illegal firearm in my possession, and I commit a crime with it, if I hold up a store in Philadelphia with an illegally obtained firearm and I'm caught with it, what's supposed to happen to me right now?
Well, there's maybe two questions there. One is if you have an illegal firearm, because that can be by itself prosecuted federally, even if you don't use it to hold up a store or what have you. So you cannot be a felon in possession of a firearm. So we get lots of referrals to our office, and we have a very good relationship with the Philadelphia Police Department and the ATF. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms works a lot of those felon in possession cases where the cases either come directly through ATF or they come to us from the Philadelphia Police Department. We screen the cases, and we try to target the worst offenders. We try to take the worst offenders off of the street by using this felon in possession statute that we have to target particular people. Well, certainly we're targeting the crimes, but then when we look at the number of crimes, we try to take federally the ones that we think are going to have the most impact on the community, so we take the worst offenders. If you also stick up a store in Philadelphia, that's also an independent federal crime. It is a federal crime to rob any commercial establishment under the Federal Hobbs Act. And so we take those cases as well, and there can be very stiff penalties for those, very high mandatory minimums, for example. So that's a big part of our public messaging campaign, is that if you rob a commercial establishment or if you possess a firearm when you aren't allowed to, we're going to take your case federal, and there are going to be consequences. Again, it's a very different message from what potential criminals are getting from other city leaders.
Yes, and I think that's just it. Is it as simple as people feel emboldened because they just know there's not? I guess I wonder how it ends. I appreciate so much what you're saying. Does it require a force of people like you in Philadelphia and across the country to step forward and tell people, well, we're going to stop it if local officials won't? Is it people just feel so emboldened that we see the anarchy and the chaos? Only stiff federal prison time will stop it? Is that the thinking?
I think it's a big part of the equation, and it's proven to work. And it's essentially just human nature. If people know that there are going to be consequences to criminal behavior, they tend not to engage in it. And if they know there aren't going to be consequences, essentially anything goes, or the system is going to be treating them like they're not responsible for what they do, well, then they're going to commit more crimes. I mean, it's like it's as simple as 1 + 1 = 2. And certainly we made a lot of progress in this city, before the circumstances that we've had in the last couple of years, where homicides were going down, shootings were going down, violent crime was going down. All the statistics were going in the right direction. And we've seen this explosion in homicides and shootings and serious violent crime in the last 2.5 years. And in my opinion, it's not a coincidence.
Bill McSween is the U.S. attorney in the southeastern portion of Pennsylvania. The surge in crime that we're seeing in all our major metropolitan cities, we saw that awful video of the man just beaten unconscious in the street in Portland. You know, I know Tucker Carlson this week, I know you've been on his show, was lamenting that, you know, people are not even free in certain parts of the country to drive through a city, down a city street, without being stopped and forced to turn around. And he was lamenting and crying out, you know, it's the federal government's responsibility to step in and stop this if local law enforcement won't. Is that where we are? Have our local law enforcement agencies just been either so hamstrung or silenced or sidelined, whatever the terminology you want to use, that now only U.S. attorneys like yourself and Attorney General Barr must step in to stop this?
I think it depends on the area that you're talking about, and the different cities across the country are in very different situations. I think Portland is a very unfortunate situation where it looks like, and again, I'm not an expert on Portland, and I'm getting a lot of this from what I see in the news and also what I talk to my colleagues about. I know the U.S. attorney out in Oregon, Billy Williams, who's doing an excellent job, I think, under very difficult circumstances, but the local authorities are not really doing what they're supposed to do out in Portland, and the police force seems like it's not supported to the point where it can go in and do the things it's supposed to do. That's different from Philadelphia. We still have a very professional, very capable Philadelphia Police Department that we have a great relationship with, that we partner with every day. And we have a police commissioner who's in a very difficult situation, but she's doing her very best every day to support her officers. And I think it's one of the things that the city can be most proud of is the quality of the Philadelphia Police Department. So we haven't seen the kind of violence, the kind of anarchy, the kind of complete breakdown of the structures of society in Philadelphia like we've seen in places like Portland. We've had our problems, and we certainly had widespread looting and unrest at the end of May and the beginning of June. And federally, we've charged a lot of those cases, and we're going to have a lot more coming. But the Philadelphia police sort of got things under control quickly, and I think that is to their credit, and that distinguishes Philadelphia from a lot of other cities around the country.
Yeah, I don't mean to make you speak, because I know you can't with authority, but when you look at, say, New York City and Chicago, are those police, I mean, as you view the local law enforcement agencies, are you, I guess it's your assessment, 30,000-foot view, that most local big city law enforcement agencies are holding their own, they're hanging on, whether it's Miami, whether it's Boston, New York, Chicago, St. Louis, they're doing okay for the most part?
I think they're doing their very best under very difficult circumstances. Certainly in New York, you have a very professional police force. They've done incredible things over the last several years, getting homicides down to a lower number than even Philadelphia, far lower than Philadelphia up until this year, with a population, you know, which is multiples of Philadelphia. So New York has a terrific police department. Chicago, very difficult circumstances, but they're doing their best and haven't seen the kind of complete anarchy and violence like you've seen in places like Portland. So by and large, I think the local police departments are responsible for the street crime, and they've handled it as best they can, but in the places where they don't have any support or do not have sufficient support from the local elected leaders, it makes it that much more difficult. It has an effect on morale. It has an effect on policing techniques. And of course, police brutality and relations with the community are things that need to be taken very seriously. Nobody's in favor of police brutality. And anything that occurs that the police get involved in that could be illegal needs to be dealt with. There needs to be accountability. But having this extreme anti-law enforcement bias that puts police on their heels and puts violent criminals on their toes, ready to stride forward confidently, that doesn't help anybody. And in fact, it ends up harming the most vulnerable members of society. It largely ends up harming minority, low-income neighborhoods, which need police. They need to protect the residents from this kind of violence. They need to protect local businesses. And so, as is often the case, the policies that are demanded by the self-righteous mob come at the expense of minority communities.
Yeah, it's strange. As I talk to you, it occurs to me that maybe I have put it in too much of a homogenous stew when we talk about the various issues from city to city. It occurs to me that the anarchy we watch in one city does not necessarily mean the sad and shocking murder and gun violence in another city. They are actually, they're huge problems independently, but they are not of the same ilk. They're different circumstances, different symptoms, I guess. But it feels, I think, to a lot of we voters, it just feels like there's just mass lawlessness and a total breakdown of law enforcement across the country, whether it's the massive shootings in number in Chicago and Philadelphia, or whether it's the anarchy that we see the visuals of in Portland. I think they glom all together, in my mind anyway. You know what I'm saying?
I do understand that you can get that impression, certainly from watching the news and being informed about what's going on around the country. But I think each city is somewhat unique. Each situation on the ground is unique. We have a lot of positives in Philadelphia, one of those positives being that we have an excellent police force. But I've also talked about the culture of lawlessness in Philadelphia, which I think is the root of a lot of the problems that we do have. And that plays out in a lot of different ways. It plays out with the violent crime. I think, it even plays out in situations like you have the homeless encampment on the parkway now, where the city leaders say, well, this is going to end on X date. And then X date comes and goes, and the city backs down. And the reason that happens is because, you cry wolf one too many times, and people aren't going to believe you anymore. And if you lose your credibility, then what do you have? So you have, the people who aren't obeying the law and who aren't respecting the law have the upper hand. And that is not something that is going to serve anybody's long-term interests.
Bill McSwain, the campaign formally, Fed Crime Gets Fed Time. It's the Fed Crime Gets Fed Time initiative. I don't know about anybody else, but to me, it lowers my blood pressure a little bit to talk to you and know that there are serious people looking at serious crimes and wanting to treat them as such seriously instead of negotiating with it or trying to, quote, understand it or whatever, thing we're being told right now. So thank you so much for your time and your vigilance, and I hope you'll come back. You're always welcome.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me. Take care.
I meant to give away a T-shirt earlier, and I didn't do it. I lied to you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. How about now? Telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990.
Caller number 12, come on in here. I'll give you a brand new AM 990 The Answer t-shirt. Andrew C. McCarthy on the way at 8 o'clock. Are we getting closer on this Durham investigation wrapping up or not? And if so, are we going to see some prosecutions? Maybe. Or not. Full details and analysis with Andy coming up at 8 o'clock. Oh, I have to tell you about a big exclusive I taped yesterday. I'll tell you who that's with next on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer. Inching up on 7:30 here, middle of the week. Thank you so much for choosing to dial us up this morning. I appreciate it. Wherever you listen, whether it's on the radio traditionally, whether it is streaming, 990theanswer.com, our app. I know a lot of people do. Not just here in the Philadelphia area, but all over the country. Welcome in today, and thank you so much for choosing the show. And I hope you'll also go to ChrisStegall.com or check out one of my social media platforms, too, whether that's Facebook, whether that's Instagram, whether that's Parler, whether that's Twitter, because today I have a digital exclusive. I was not allowed to do it here on the radio show, unfortunately. They wouldn't allow it. But I was granted some time with the Biden campaign yesterday. And this morning, I can tell you that it is up for you to watch. It's my exclusive sit down, and I was shocked as you were to find out that I got the time, but I was granted a bit of time with Joe Biden from the House yesterday, and it's available for you to watch at your leisure right now. I've got it up on Facebook this morning. We posted it at Twitter, at Parler, and Instagram too. They said the only condition was that I not air it here. So it's. You know, time is tight. This was a coveted interview. I mean, of course, he was formally accepted the nomination last night. So this was ahead of that, in advance of it last night. And then, you know, on to, well, he'll be speaking on, he spoke a little bit yesterday, right? And I guess Thursday's the big rollout tomorrow. So this was a big one. I think I'm the only conservative out there that got the interview. So check it out if you're curious. You know, I always wish we could have more time. You always want more time. But anyway, we got the time. We were grateful for it. So I've got that posted at Facebook this morning. Do you want to go to Facebook.com/ChrisStegall, ChrisStigall, and check it out. Now, Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, spoke last night at the Democrat convention. By the way, Andy McCarthy coming up at 8 o'clock. AOC speaks last night, and here's some of it.
Good evening, bienvenidos, and thank you to everyone here today endeavoring towards a better, more just future for our country and our world. In fidelity and gratitude to a mass people's movement working to establish 21st century social, economic, and human rights, including guaranteed health care, higher education, living wages, and labor rights for all people in the United States. A movement striving to recognize and repair the wounds of racial injustice, colonization, misogyny, and homophobia, and to propose and build reimagined systems of immigration and foreign policy that turn away from the violence and xenophobia of our past. A movement that realizes the unsustainable brutality of an economy that rewards explosive inequalities of wealth for the few at the expense of long-term stability for the many, and who organized a historic grassroots campaign to reclaim our democracy.
30 seconds left, folks.
In a time when millions of people in the United States are looking for deep systemic solutions to our crises of mass evictions, unemployment, and lack of health care, in el espíritu del pueblo, and out of a love for all people, I hereby second the nomination of Senator Bernard Sanders of Vermont for President of the United States of America.
What? She seconds the nomination of Bernard Sanders with a little Espanol for good measure. 60 seconds. That's what she got. Hell, I could hang on to the mechanical bull down there at Xfinity Live for longer than that. She threw in there. Doug Schoen over at Fox News said, Ocasio-Cortez's speech, now he's a Democrat, mind you. He said Democrats did not succeed in convincing Americans they can trust this new Democrat Party to pursue policies and interests that will bring the country together and move us forward in a moderate and inclusive direction. AOC was totally out of step with the tenor of the vast majority of speeches. Now, did you notice what she did not say? What in her 60-second allotment? And again, a reminder, Republicans in this convention have been given tons more time to speak than she has. Christine Todd Whitman, Johnny Pancakes with the giant pants and multicolored belt, Cindy McCain, Colin Powell, Meg Whitman, all Republicans, allegedly, that I just named. All of them have been given, you add them together, 20 minutes or more? Of this convention so far, she got 60 seconds. And in that 60 seconds she was given, what did she not say? What one name did she never utter? Fast Eddie.
Joe Biden?
That's right, the guy they nominated last night, Joe Biden. Now where, I ask again, as I asked all through the primary, where's the enthusiasm in this party? Where is the enthusiasm? Is it for him? No, we know it's not. Why? The polls that have been released prove it. Even their own party is not excited about voting for Biden. They're excited to vote against Trump. Trump voters are excited to vote for Trump. Biden voters don't care about Biden. They just hate Trump. But Bernie bros love Bernie, and they love AOC, and the energy and the enthusiasm is in the looting and the burning and the statue toppling and the defunding of the cops. And a little Espanol thrown in for good measure. And the lunacy about mailboxes being swiped and kids being thrown in cages at the border. And all this rot that they've sold. That's where the energy and excitement is. And you know what it was given? 60 seconds. 60 seconds, and it didn't even mention Biden when they gave it. So I say again, and I'm doubling down on this, tripling down on this, the best thing that could ever happen to Bernie Sanders types and AOC herself is for Joe Biden to go down in flames, to let Donald Trump have another 4 years. Because when it's over, I promise you, the likes of, folks, I want you to think, no one thinks of it this way, and it's difficult for us to think this way. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Joe Biden, and then all those linguine-spined Republicans I just mentioned that are all speaking. Do you know what they are to the AOCs? You know what they are in our equivalent, in our parlance, in our lexicon as conservatives, as Republicans? Those people that I just mentioned are Mitt Romney, the late John McCain, Colin Powell, John Kasich. They are the very people the party has completely turned its back on. They are the people that don't even show up at the Republican convention next week. They're the people who have fought tooth and nail the Republican president. Because the Republican Party's in the midst of a transformation, or it's happened under Donald Trump. This is also happening in the Democrat Party, but they don't know it yet. They're fighting hard against their own Donald Trump movement, except their Donald Trump movement is Bernie and AOC. And they don't know it yet, but they can't stop this. The dam is breaking, and they're trying to plug it with a couple little rocks and a couple of their fingers. Sorry to use that analogy with Bill Clinton and the mix, but my point is they're desperate to try to keep this dam from breaking, but they can't much longer. The progressive dam is about to burst and swallow this entire party whole, and they're trying to pretend that's not who they are. Just like many in the Republican Party would love to try to pretend Donald Trump isn't what the Republican Party is. It's not going to work. It didn't work for the Republicans, and it's not going to work for Democrats. And the best thing that can happen to progressive Democrats is Donald Trump winning this election this fall. Because once and for all, they'll be able to put a political shovel heap of dirt on John Kerry and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. Finally, they can dispatch with this notion that they're somehow moderate and get on about the business of being the progressive radicals they truly are at their heart. You see Josh Shapiro, the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, signed on with 20 other states to sue the post office. This is the dumbest damn thing. Emergency legislation, you know. We got Congress reconvening this week to tackle the crisis at the post office. Wink. The Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, spoke yesterday and said, okay, like, fine, I'll just not do any of the stuff we planned on doing. The post office is hemorrhaging money by the billions every minute of every day. But okay, all right, fine. If it makes you people feel better, you're lunatics. And this was on the chopping block and had been in the process of happening all along since 2006. But okay, if you're going to make a deal out of this, fine. We're just not going to do anything. Okay, so I'll wait till the election's over. Then we'll get back to the business of trying to figure out how to get our finances of the post office in shape. Everybody happy? So Shapiro and the 20 other attorneys general from the different states said, okay, well, good. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he backed down. That's right. We made the Postmaster General stand down. That's right. Don't make us come and get you, Postmaster General DeJoy. Okay. So that's effectively what they said yesterday. Okay, fine. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to let the post office continue to hemorrhage money for the next 3 months just so you can continue with this fictitious mail-in ballot scheme that you've got cooked up, Democrats. Fine. So they have no teeth anymore, these Democrats, screaming and yelling that the president, along with the Postmaster General, are cooking up some, you know, craven seizure of mailboxes to keep people from voting or whatever the hell it is. The Inquirer this morning is guiding voters here in our region as to their deadlines. October 19th in Pennsylvania is your deadline to register to vote. In New Jersey, October 13th. In Delaware, October 10th. To apply for a mail-in ballot in Pennsylvania, October 27th. You have until October 27th to apply for a mail-in ballot. Now, do you think, what are the odds that somebody applies for a mail-in ballot on October 27th, receives that mail-in ballot 7 days within the 7-day window before the election, and then you have until 8 o'clock on election day, supposedly, technically, for your ballot to count in Pennsylvania? That's as it stands right now, but remember, the Secretary of State is formally requesting that we'll be allowed 3 days past Election Day to certify the vote. Folks, if election night comes down to Pennsylvania again, we could be Florida. I want you to stop and consider that election night and into the next day and the next day and the next day and maybe the weeks thereafter, buckle up for the possibility. I just want you to get your mind around this. That much like the Bush versus Gore election of the year 2000, in the year 2020, Pennsylvania could very well be the new hanging chad. That this time counting the mail-in ballot, courtesy of our Secretary of State and our Supreme Court, run by Democrats in Pennsylvania. I'm not predicting it. I'm just saying get ready for the distinct possibility. Bill Hemmer had his what if electoral vote map out on Fox News last night. He started running the numbers on who could get to 270 and how. And every scenario always wound up with Pennsylvania being the one. Neither of them could quite get there until Pennsylvania fell. So he ran all these different schematics. Well, you win Florida, you lose Florida, you win Ohio, and you pick up Texas, but then you don't win Minnesota, and then you buppity buppity buppity. He ran 300 different confusing mathematical scenarios. None of them ever included Pennsylvania. Because if either of them win Pennsylvania, it's ball game. It's 20 electoral votes, and it absolutely kicks it into the stratosphere, and nobody can touch the person that wins Pennsylvania. We all understand that. So I can easily see a scenario where our Democrat Secretary of State, in conjunction with God knows who at the Supreme Court and our Attorney General, and I mean, think about the people involved. I want you to stop and think about the principal players involved in Pennsylvania politics if, God forbid, we should become the Florida of 2020. Do you feel good about that for Donald Trump? If it comes down to, oh, we've got more ballots to count. You know, it looks like Trump, but Trump's only got about a 10,000-vote lead in Pennsylvania. I don't know. There's more votes to count. I need some more time. There's some more mail-in ballots. Seriously, if it comes down to Trump wins Pennsylvania by 10,000 votes, 20,000 votes, you think Democrats are going to be able to find it?
I'm a lifelong Philadelphian, Chris. They will find them all over the city.
And here's a recent letter from the Postal Service, they write today in the Inquirer, warning that mail ballots might not be delivered on time, makes the threat to Pennsylvanians' right to vote unmistakably clear and concrete. To state it simply, voters who apply for mail-in ballots in the last week of the application period and return their completed ballot by mail will, through no fault of their own, likely be disenfranchised, says Josh Shapiro's lawsuit. So the post office said before this supposed scheme that Donald Trump cooked up, the post office already told Pennsylvania. They already told the Secretary of State, we cannot get ballots to people and then take in an infusion of ballots on election day and make sure they're all to you and counted by 8 o'clock on election night. It can't happen, Secretary of State in Pennsylvania. We don't have the ability. We can't do it. So Josh Shapiro files a lawsuit against the post office. To fix that, how? What exactly does he think Donald Trump and the Postmaster General are going to do to make that faster for everybody? Or make sure that everybody... Does anybody think, again, this is so absurd, we're asked to have our Christmas cards, our packages in the mail, how far in advance? Before Christmas?
I think it's 2 weeks.
I do, too. Yeah. I think it's every bit of 2 weeks. Or you can't be guaranteed that your gift or your card will arrive in the mail by Christmas. But we're supposed to now expect that the Postal Service is going to get a ballot to your mailbox as late as the final 7 days before Election Day. You will then fill it out, drop it in your mailbox, and it will be returned to the place it's to be counted by 8 o'clock on election night. Let me ask you this. If you dropped something in the mail today and you just wanted to mail it, let's see, I don't know. You're in Center City, Philadelphia, and you wanted to mail something to Bucks County. Do you have the confidence that it would arrive there within 7 days? Would you hand me a $100 bill and say, you're going to owe me that $100 back or you can keep it if this letter I'm mailing from Center City to Bucks County doesn't get there in 7 days? I know I could open the phone right now. I could do nothing but take calls from people. Could tell me stories about local mail that went missing or lost or didn't get somewhere for days upon days upon days. Got another text from a friend yesterday. These texts are going out. I shared with you the story of the text that I got to my phone saying, hi, Anna. My name's Lisa Marie. You got to stay safe. We want everybody to vote from home. Can we count on you to fill out this prepaid ballot and mail it in so that your vote counts on election day? Now, Anna is my 12-year-old daughter. And again, that was a text to my phone. I started getting more people telling me they're receiving similar correspondence. So a friend of mine named Reese. All right, this woman's name is Reese. She gets this text yesterday. Hi, Teresa. Huh? Again, my friend's name is Reese. She gets a text that says, hi, Teresa. I'm Allie, a volunteer with Indivisible Action. In Pennsylvania, all voters can now apply for mail-in ballots to be able to vote by mail for the November election. Will you be able to vote by mail? What's going on here?
Sounds like spam text.
Why? From who? Who's sending them? To what end? Just to sow discord? Maybe. 610-850-0990, the number. This is so it's so clear and disgusting and obvious what's going on here. Rather than you just show up at your polling place and vote, and in New Jersey, oh, that mess. Everybody gets a ballot. You get a ballot. You get a. Why don't they just fly planes over New Jersey and just drop ballots out of the plane? You can just grab one from the street. So disgusting what they're doing. This is Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Now, more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner. We had a couple of winners in this hour. A brand spanking new t-shirt, and somebody's going to go meet Dr. Spinato as well, Edward.
Yep, that's Sam in Sewell, New Jersey.
Congratulations, Sam. Who won that t-shirt earlier in the hour, too?
That was Barbara in Eagleville.
Eagleville. Which part of New Jersey again, by the way?
Sewell.
Sewell, New Jersey. All right. Thank you. I like it. Splitting it between the states, just as it ought to be. Hey, coming up in just a minute, we're going to talk with Andrew C. McCarthy. You know, Sally Yates, the Obama acting attorney general on the way out the door, she spoke last night at the DNC. We got that next.
You live here. He lives here.
Hey, Chris, you're doing a great job, and I really appreciate everything you're doing for this country.
I saw your billboard, and I've been tuned in to 990 since.
Listening online, really glad that I found you again. When I lived in North Coventry, PA, that's how I got hip to you.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. It's a beautiful day.
For nearly 30 years, through Democratic and Republican administrations, I worked alongside my DOJ colleagues to advance our nation's promise of equal justice. I served as Deputy Attorney General in the Obama-Biden administration and stayed on as Acting Attorney General for the Trump transition. Then, 10 days in, I was fired for refusing to defend President Trump's shameful and unlawful Muslim travel ban. His constant attacks on the FBI, the free press, inspectors general, federal judges, they all have one purpose: to remove any check on his abuse of power.
Sally Yates, given prime time last night on the DNC stage, such that it was, to address the nation. Pretty rich coming from her, isn't it? Former federal prosecutor, author of a must-read book if you want to understand Obamagate, Russiagate, whatever you want to refer to it as. It's called Ball of Collusion. Andrew C. McCarthy, Fox News contributor, National Review online contributor, joins me again. Andy, welcome back. Good morning.
Chris, great to be with you.
So, how credible is Ms. Yates there, given what we know? Just, what, a couple of weeks ago, she told Lindsey Graham, knowing now, what if she knew then what she knows now, she never would have signed off on allowing the FISA surveillance and that kind of thing. I mean, that's which is proof positive that she believes subversive stuff was going on under her nose.
Well, not only that, Chris, but as she was giving her remarks last night, it looks like the FBI lawyer who was involved in the middle of putting together the fourth surveillance warrant on Carter Page, long after it was well known that the Steele dossier was farcical, after they were told, long after they were told by the CIA that Carter Page had actually been a CIA source working against Russia, while they, in their FISA applications, were portraying him as a Russian source working against the United States, long after all that, this FBI lawyer is poised today to plead guilty to manipulating or falsifying a document and making false statements in connection with this investigation. And that is under circumstances where the false statements are in connection with this FISA application that should never have been even considered, let alone let out of the Justice Department to go to the FISA court. And I just think it's interesting that it's happening with her remarks still ringing in our ears.
Yes.
And under not enough with not enough attention to the fact that this is remarkably gone pretty much unmentioned Chris, but this fourth FISA application happened under the watch of Robert Mueller. The FISA, the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane investigation was transferred from the FBI to the Mueller investigation when Mueller was appointed on May 17th. This FISA warrant was issued on June 29th. By the time it was issued, and at the time that Kevin Kleinsmith, the lawyer who's going to plead guilty today, at the time he was engaged in his shenanigans, Robert Mueller had been running this investigation for over a month.
Stunning.
So I just think it's pretty interesting timing.
What do we make of someone like Sally Yates? And you're a good man, and you give the benefit of the doubt to people that I wouldn't. So I really trust you, and I earnestly ask this question. What do you make of someone like Sally Yates, acting attorney general during this transfer from the Obama presidency to the Trump presidency? She claims, you know, she was stunned and shocked at this suggestion of trying to go after Flynn under the terms of the Logan Act. She said she heard about it first from that meeting with Obama and Biden. I mean, she acted at some point in testimony, even a couple of weeks ago with Lindsey Graham, like she was sort of this hapless victim in all of it. But last night she gives this speech like she just, you know, she's for truth, justice, and the American way, and she could no longer stand idly by as Trump tried to subvert checks on his power. It's, what are we to make of this person?
Well, I have a much more jaundiced position on her than what I'm deriving from what the Justice Department has portrayed. I think in connection with the Flynn case, you're right that they have tried to portray her as more of a dupe than anything else, who was taken in by, who was basically run over by Comey. And, you know, she basically went along with the program during that Senate hearing, agreeing with the committee that Comey had gone rogue and all that stuff. I don't see it that way. I mean, I think, you know, first of all, this idea that she was out of the loop and she had to find out from Obama that that Flynn had had these conversations with Kislyak, and Obama had already been briefed by Comey, but Yates was left out of the loop. That's not what happened. I mean, what happened was Comey's deputy, McCabe, briefed one of Yates's direct reports, Mary McCord, who was the head of the National Security Division, the day before they were all supposed to meet in the White House. The fact that the information didn't work its way up the Justice Department chain of command was not Comey's doing or Obama's doing. They obviously talked about the Flynn thing in front of her because they assumed that she was up to speed. The fact that she wasn't was based on the way she ran the Justice Department, not that they were holding out on her. They had no hesitation whatsoever in discussing this with her. And look, Chris, common sense says if I'm right and the goal of this whole operation was to start this investigation and then continue it into the Trump administration, the only way you could pull that off would be if you had the cooperation of the two top Obama Justice Department people who were going to continue into the Trump administration, who would have been Sally Yates at the Justice Department and Jim Comey at the FBI. If you didn't have that, if there wasn't a commitment on their part to withhold information about the Russia investigation from the incoming Trump team, which is what we now know they discussed on January 5th, then the investigation couldn't have continued. And she may not have thought the Logan Act was a sensible basis for investigating Flynn, but she certainly didn't object to it. When she went over to tell Don McGahn, who was the White House counsel, that the FBI had interviewed Flynn, she didn't show up there to object to the fact that the FBI broke protocol to go to the White House without telling anybody about it and have that interview. Her pitch to McGahn was that Flynn was a big problem. And her suggestion to McGahn was that Flynn's conversations with Kislyak were problematic. Now, we know they weren't problematic. The only way that she could have suggested that they were is if she bought on to the Logan Act theory that, you know, the mere fact that Flynn was having these conversations was a problem. And as to what she said yesterday about, you know, quitting when Trump issued his what she called her Muslim travel ban, it wasn't a Muslim travel ban, and it was upheld by the courts.
Right. And the Supreme Court, yes.
Her job was to enforce it, and she was fired because she insubordinately refused to enforce it. And in the Justice Department, you have, you know, basically you have two honorable options. If you think that you're being asked to do something that's dicey, but you're not sure whether it's absolutely dicey or not, your alternative is, you know, to try to talk them out of it. But if you lose, you can either honorably resign or you have to salute and follow your orders. And she instead decided to be insubordinate and try to block the enforcement of it. And that was why she was fired. So, you know, what she's bragging about, I don't quite get.
And Andy, this is the thing. This is going to make a lot of people, you know, scream at their radio, I understand. And they'll get tired of me even trying to find this. I earnestly don't want to assign everybody involved in this with malice, bad intent, you know, that they're bad people. I want to believe some people just make a mistake or they really thought that. But I have no choice but to look at a Sally Yates, and she's got that lovely little Southern lilt. And, you know, she seems like such a nice kind of. You know, but I have no choice but to look at this woman and say, well, she is not of goodwill. She's not of good faith. She's willfully lying. She's a bad. I have no choice as an American in 2020 but to look at someone like Sally Yates and say, you are not a good person. You are lying to the American people about your role in this and who Donald Trump is. And you know it. And you know it. And I'd hook her up to a lie detector and I think she'd fail it. Andy, and I know you're a more reasoned guy than me this way, but those are my emotions just coursing through me. I have no choice but to sign a bad intent to people like her and James Comey and Andrew McCabe. Maybe you don't.
Well, you know, look, I think that whether she acted in bad faith or not, you know, I don't think I have to get inside her mind in order to look at what happened here and say this is incredibly wrong. I mean, I have to tell you, Chris, and I think you and I have talked about this before, but when I was a federal prosecutor, I got the privilege of working on some pretty important cases when I was there. And there was never a time that my bosses, when we were going to do something that was even borderline controversial, didn't want to know everything I knew about what we were about to do. I mean, the idea that, you know, you're sitting around the office and they say, what are you going to do today? Or what do you think you're going to be working on the next week or two? It, you know, if I turned around and said, well, you know, I think I'm going to get a wiretap on the campaign of the President of the United States, I think the answer would have been, you're going to what? And they would have made me go through every bit of my evidence and, you know, why I thought that was an appropriate thing to do. And when instead you look at, you know, Yates and some of the other people who signed off on these FISA warrants, I mean, think for a second about, by the time that Yates signs off on the last FISA warrant that she signed off on, it was already known for months that they hadn't been able to corroborate the Steele dossier. Yeah. And I've been saying from the beginning, Chris, that just looking at the Steele dossier, it's an absurd product. I mean, it's very poorly done. It turns out that all the stuff we heard about how Christopher Steele had given them, you know, really key information in connection with other investigations turns out to be a vast overstatement. But they didn't even bother. They knew that he was not somebody who had firsthand information from anybody in Russia. They knew that. And he had been a signed-up FBI informant for months, even before the Trump stuff came up. So in a normal, competent investigation like that, if you're about to take a heavy-duty step based on a guy like this and he doesn't have the direct information, you say to him, since he's your informant, well, who are your sources? And then you don't wait until February to talk to his primary subsource. You talk to him right there and then before you do anything.
Yeah, and who should
and
be?
Yet, what,
yeah, sorry, Andy, but who should
well,
be?
Well, I could say, well, no, but what do we get? We get they rely on this farcical dossier that had absolutely no support, and they lie about what the CIA told them about Carter Page.
Yes.
And that's their warrant.
And she's given a primetime speaking gig at the DNC, and, you know, she's booked this morning. I mean, as we talk, she's coming up with Joe Scarborough as a featured guest on Morning Joe. I mean, like, she's a celebrated figure. It's just disgusting. But anyway, moving off this, this Kleinsmith, whatever, this attorney that's pleading guilty, how significant is this, and what exactly is he pleading guilty to today? Kind of help us, if you could, truncate what's going down here today.
Well, let's be clear. We think he's going to plead guilty today. Until I'm
right.
As someone who used to do this, until it happens, I won't. I'm not going to say it'll happen because we all thought it was going to happen Friday, and it didn't. But what he's pleading guilty to is basically making false statements to the FBI. And in a nutshell, what he did was he learned from the CIA, and this was not the first time the Bureau had learned this, but it was evidently the first time he learned it, when they were preparing to do the fourth warrant on Page, the FBI agent who was going to be the affiant, meaning he was going to swear out the warrant, was disturbed because Page was saying publicly that he had been a source for U.S. intelligence agencies. So the agent basically said to Kleinsmith, who was the FBI lawyer, who was basically their liaison with the CIA, among other things he did, he said, I'm not signing this thing until we run down whether this guy was a CIA source or not. And Kleinsmith's job was to get with the CIA. And basically the CIA tells Kleinsmith, look, we told you back in October 2016 he was a source. Basically, I think knowing how embarrassing it would have been for the FBI at that point, remember, this is now the fourth warrant, so they've been relying on something. The premise of their investigation is that Page is working with Russia against America, and now it turns out they've known since October, before the warrant even started, back in October 2016, that he was actually working with the United States against Russia. So you can imagine how embarrassing that would have been if they had gone to the FISA court and said, oops, you know, our whole theory here is nonsense. So basically what he did was he changed a document that said he was a source so that it would say he was not a source. And he gave that information to the agent who was going to swear out the warrant, including telling him that the CIA had explicitly told him that Page was not a source, when in fact they had told him exactly the opposite.
Andy, this is all in your book and so much more, but I asked Don Jr. this yesterday, and I keep kind of inquiring to people who are with the Trump campaign, principals that we have on the show, how important is this story? Are you going to try to tell it, or is it just too much? Like, is it so big, so episodic? I've asked you this 1,000 times, I think, in many interviews over the last couple of years. How this story is so big with so many layers and so many players and facets, it's tough to follow, and you certainly can't airdrop in and pick it all up in one conversation. How significant is this story to tell if you're the Trump campaign, if you were advising them, versus the other issues going on in the country?
I think it's very significant, and maybe because I was a trial lawyer in a lot of long cases, there's a way that you tell a sprawling story to people. There's a way you tell it to a jury. You can't do a case without that. And that is, Chris, you find two or three things thematically that people can hang their hat on as they hear all these disparate facts. So you want to hammer at what the themes are, and then you give them something to organize their understanding around this. And the theme of this should be out-and-out fraud. This was fraud from the beginning. The more we find out about this, the more we find that they relied on things that were untrue, and the only explanations for that are either corruption or incompetence. So, you know, I don't think it's that hard to tell the story. I think the problem the Trump campaign has is right now the coronavirus and the street violence are much bigger stories as far as the American people's attention span is concerned. Mm-hmm. I think everybody has kind of an impression already of what went on in the Trump-Russia investigation. I think it's pretty commonly understood by people of goodwill, that that was an investigation that shouldn't have been commenced, even if they don't know all the details of it. I think it should be a much bigger story, because if it is what I suspect it is, it's Watergate-level misconduct. But, you know, even Watergate-level misconduct, Chris, is not going to grab people by the throat if the people who committed it are no longer in power. And I don't know that they're going to be able to hang this around Biden, because, you know, the Trump theme about Biden is that, you know, the elevator ain't making it to the top floor anymore, right? So it's not exactly like...
Well, that's right.
You're not going to be able to convince people that he was hands-on with respect to this investigation.
That's always...
non-compos mentis.
I agree. That's always what I've said about Trump critics, too. People have always said he's a doofus, he's a boob, he's a buffoon, you know, but then he's always secretly plotting some maniacal thing about seizing mailboxes and things. It can't be both. So I agree with that. And also, given that, again, the Democrats and, you know, Morning Joe, Mika, right now making a star out of Sally Yates like she's some kind of, I mean, they make celebrities out of these people. They don't punish them. Hey, quickly, just a matter of housekeeping. I do have to run, but a friend of mine, this may be a little down in the weeds, Durham and this investigation. I don't know if it's wrapping up or if we're still hip deep in it, but he asked me to ask you this, and I thought it was a good question. Is Durham privy to all the stuff that Congress investigated ahead of him? My friend said that he is being told or has heard that Durham may have to find his own or do his own discovery of things and not be privy to what Congress found. Do you know about that one way or the other? And if so, does that make Durham way behind the eight ball, or can he just tap into what Congress has already done?
Ordinarily, the FBI, I mean, the prosecutor is privy to everything that Congress has done, because there are ways to get that information. And a lot of it is public. Anyhow, most of it's now been released, but he would have been able to get that. It doesn't work the other way around. That is, Congress can't get everything. I mean, they could try, but they can't get everything that the prosecutor is doing. But usually the prosecutor can do everything, you get everything Congress has, because Congress doesn't want to look, Chris, like they're obstructing an investigation. So they don't want a story out there that they're, you know, basically subverting a prosecutor. So there are things I would worry about. That would not be one of them.
Durham is close, you think? Is this about the wrap?
Well,
you have a sense of it.
Yeah, look, I think this case today is a big deal. So, we'll have to see if this is like the first of many dominoes to fall or if it's a one-off. But it doesn't seem to me like it's a one-off.
Andrew C. McCarthy is the author of the best-selling book Ball of Collusion. It really is sort of your Bible if you want to understand this story soup to nuts. Obamagate, Russiagate, whatever you want to call it. He is a contributor to National Review Online, Fox News, and has been a great, great friend of this show for a long time. And I'm so grateful to you this morning, Andy. Thank you.
Chris, have a great day.
Chris DeGaul now. Mike Gallagher at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
This is unbelievable, folks. Or maybe it's totally believable, but I just can't get over what a spineless, worthless, I'm running out of adjectives for the toilet czar, this mayor of Philadelphia. So yesterday, the toilet czar, big bad mayor of Philadelphia, Jim Kenney, said, "That's it, you homeless encampment people. At 9 o'clock Tuesday morning, you're going to be off the parkway and out of there. I've had it. We've come to a loggerheads, and that's it. No more. You're out of here." Well, no. Didn't happen. Yeah, incorrect. Didn't happen. Didn't happen. Homeless camp stays put. Plans to clear out two Philadelphia encampments where dozens of homeless people lived in tents for months have been postponed until at least tomorrow, after residents of the encampments filed a lawsuit. Homeless people filed a lawsuit to stay camped out on public space. And the mayor and the cops stood down and acquiesced. And during the press conference, the toilet czar said, "Well, I just can't accede to the demand that they're making without cooperation from the feds and the state." And you know what they're demanding? They want permanent housing. The sticking point is the word permanent. How about the sticking point is you negotiating squat? There is no sticking point because you don't have a hand to play because you're homeless. You do not get to tell the city or city officials how things are going to go. We're going to tell you how to go. Get out or you will be forcibly removed. The end. There's nothing to discuss. There's no ceding to demands. The sticking point between the administration and the encampment has been the word permanent. City officials say they're offering pathways to permanent housing, putting up residents of encampments in shelters. But protesters say the city should assign residents vacant public housing units. The city says, well, we can't do that without federal help because some of that doesn't have electricity and plumbing. We can't just give you houses that don't have electricity and plumbing. We need help with that. Well, then we're not leaving, say the homeless people. And the mayor says, okay, I guess I really wish you would, though. He said that without an amicable resolution or blocking from a federal judge, a sweep of the encampment is imminent. At some point in time, this has to end. So again, this jackass will tear down statues indiscriminately, without thought. This guy will let buildings burn and be looted without thought, without reservation. He'll let chaos sweep the city without reservation. But boy, if a homeless guy starts shouting, I have an attorney and I have every right to be here pantsless and injecting heroin on the parkway if I want to be. He piddles himself and runs away. I don't know what to do. Homeless guy has an attorney. Shut up, you limp-wristed, linguine-spined loser. Get them the hell out. Throw them off the parkway. They're homeless. They're pantsless. They're laying in their own waste. Quit treating them like they're Johnny Cochran a la O.J. Simpson trial. Oh, for God's sakes, what an embarrassment, this weenie. Well, I've had it. I know I said yesterday was it, but I mean it this time. Thursday's it. Right, sure it is, tough guy. 610-850-0990, the number. 610-850-0990. I have so little time for this guy. Imagine people paying what they pay to live on the parkway to watch this. Just imagine. What an a-hole you must feel like to be paying what they pay to live on the parkway to look at this. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you just feel like a grade-A first-class a-hole if you're paying premium rents or mortgages to stare out on that?
Absolutely.
Want a shirt? I got a shirt. 610-850-0990. Caller 12, 610-850-0990. Did you see my Joe Biden exclusive interview yet? It's only digital. I wasn't allowed to air it. The Biden campaign said I could only put it up on Facebook, on my social media. Go check it out. I got to chat with him very briefly yesterday. Go to Facebook. Whiskey bottles and brand new cars. Oak tree, you're in my way. This cannot believe. All right, well, we mean it this time. Thursday's it. The number 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Trump headed out to Arizona yesterday.
Commission.
Mr. President, can I ask about Saturday, the House vote on the Postal Service bill? Is that something that you will be...
Well, we'll talk about that later. We will talk about that. The Democrats want to make it a political issue. It's not a political issue. It's really about a correct vote. You have to get voting right. You can't have millions and millions of ballots sent all over the place, sent to people that are dead, sent to dogs, cats, sent everywhere. Where this is a serious situation. This isn't games, and you have to get it right. I just want to get it right. Win, lose, or draw. I think we're going to win. Win, lose, or draw. We have to get it right.
So were they getting it right with their bill?
Well, they're going to do something in Congress, but everything they do is political. As an example, why don't they do it now instead of on Monday? They picked a day, actually. They picked another day on Monday, as you know. Well, that's when the Republican convention starts. Why don't they do it during the Democrat convention? Because everything they do, Nancy and Chuck, they play games. How's it working out? I think this is the White House, isn't it? How's it working out for them? Not so good. So I will tell you, it's disgraceful. It's disgraceful. We have to have honest voting. That's what this is all about here. It's honest voting. You can't take millions of ballots, send them haphazardly all over the country or all over a state, and expect to come out properly. And if you look at the last 10 elections where they did this universal, and by the way, absentee is great. It's been working for a long time, like in Florida. Absentee, you request, and it comes in, and then you send it back. Absentee is great. But universal is going to be a disaster, the likes of which our country has never seen.
Yeah, I have a relative that, I won't tell you who it is. But she's a mature relative. And she has vacillated between the parties. She's one of these women that I think could probably go either way. This election, so I'm unbelievably, she's one of those. I know someone like this who on any given year, depending on her feelings, may go one way or the other. She earnestly, in her heart, and she's not a dumb woman, I've talked with her about this, she earnestly believes Donald Trump and the Postmaster General are up to no good. Trying to keep people from voting. And I engaged. I almost never do this, but I did this because this is a blood relative, someone I care about. And I said, do you really believe what you're saying to me? Really? Come on. I've known you all my life. You really believe that? Yes, I do, Chris. I think it's outrageous. At this time, when people are scared and worried about their health, the idea that anybody would stand in the way of letting people vote. I said, who is standing in anyone's way to vote? Well, Trump. He's taking the mailboxes away, and he's I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. Just slow down for a second. I said, do you know me? I said, do you think that I would willfully, wantonly excuse or cheer on or dismiss or laugh at or encourage the willful, surreptitious removal of people's ballots or block people from having their right at the ballot, but to have their vote count? Do you think me, that kind of person? Do you think that I would cheer on a candidate just to win? You think I'm so desperate to win an election that I think it's important we disenfranchise people and take their vote away? Do you believe that that's who I am? See, I always like to personalize it because you have to make a leftist say to your face they think you're the bad person. You have to make them say it. And if they're capable of saying that, then there is no discussion to be had. But with this person, I knew they weren't going to say it. I knew they didn't think that of me. So she said, No, I don't think that. I said, so why do you think that I would excuse something that I believed would be robbing people of their right to vote? And she kind of calmly wondered about it for a second. You know, she kind of suggested maybe I didn't quite understand what was. I said, may I just offer up a simple question to you. I mean, this is really just, I just want to walk this out with you. What about the system that we have presently concerns you? Setting aside coronavirus, setting aside the mail-in ballot kerfuffle of today, what about our system heretofore concerns you? Well, there wasn't a concern. I didn't have a concern, she said. It was fine. I said, that's right. Why isn't it now? Well, the mailboxes. I said, no. Here's why it's not fine to you now, because you wake up respectfully and you watch the Today Show. You don't listen to me. You watch the Today Show. You watch MSNBC and Morning Joe. And those people tell you that Donald Trump is involved in stealing mailboxes and keeping people from voting. But let me tell you what's real, if you'd allow me for a minute. What's real is, if you don't want to vote in person, if you can't vote in person, if you're out of the country, if you're ill, if you're bedridden, and you can't make it to the polling place on election day, what have we always done throughout the history of this country? What have we always done? What's been in place? She correctly said absentee ballots. I said, that's right, absentee ballots. You have to request one, right? Right. I said, do you have to verify who you are when you request an absentee? You do. Yes, yes. So you fill it out. You send it in. You can do it well in advance, right? Right. It counts? Right, right. Got to certify who you are. You got to request it. They cross-reference it. Right, right. Check, check, check. I said, what's wrong with that system? She said, nothing. I said, okay, do you understand the difference between that and sending out ballots in mass like they're grocery store flyers with the latest sale on meat? You understand the difference? That's different. She didn't. What do you mean? I said, we're not talking about people requesting ballots. We're talking about ballots being sent out in mass. Now, in Pennsylvania, technically, you still have to request them. But in New Jersey, for instance, they're being sent out in mass. In, I think, 9 states or so out west, they're being just sent out in mass. Like, literally, like flyers from the store. She didn't understand that. She, as the left has done, has adequately in her mind conflated mail-in ballot and absentee ballot. She thinks they're one and the same. People are on the left are telling voters absentee ballot equals mail-in ballot, that it's the same thing. It is not the same thing. And so I said to her, okay, so now understanding that you can apply for an absentee ballot, fill it out today, right now, and mail it in, and your vote's going to count. What's the alarm? What's the difference? What's the change? This is someone that I actually actively talked down off a ledge. I said, nothing has changed. You can show up in person to vote, or you can request an absentee ballot if you're concerned about it. What? Nothing's changed. Trump's not suggesting that be changed. And why would a mailbox being there and not have anything to do with you securing an absentee ballot and mailing it in? By the time I was done, this woman, this blood relative of mine, had calmed down considerably and said, okay, I didn't really look at it that way. I didn't quite understand. She literally didn't understand it. The left had purposely muddied this and conflated storylines to make her think that Trump was out there snatching absentee ballots and not allowing them to counter some such thing. Nonetheless, it's neither here nor there. Now the Postmaster General showed up yesterday at Congress and he said, okay, never mind. We're just going to let everything go. Hell with it. Whatever. We're not doing anything. We're just going to let the post office continue to hemorrhage money till after the election. Then we'll tackle it. I mean, again, this is a smart woman. Thoughtful people are falling prey to this. And they're in utter hysterics over it. And it's inexplicable. 610-850-0990 as we take a break here. Yeah, thanks for your response to the Biden interview. Like I said, I wish we could get more time, but, you know, any time we're granted. I think I was the only conservative granted time to interview Biden yesterday, digitally anyway. So check it out. It's at Facebook this morning if you want to see it. Let me know what you think about my one-on-one with him. Brief, but, you know, I asked the tough questions. Didn't always get the answers we were hoping for. Pelosi. Nice try, Postmaster General DeJoy, but we're still going to be passing our post office legislation Saturday. So literally, she tweeted that out. Nice, like she's Wonder Woman, like a Marvel, you know, hero. Nice try, Postmaster General, and you almost got away with it. Shut up, idiot. Telephone number 610-850. Nice try! Like an episode of Scooby-Doo. Postmaster DeJoy rips off the mask. It's Trump. I gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for you meddling Democrats. Idiots. Idiots. Nice try! Yeah, you really thwarted them, Nan. 610-850-0990. I'm sorry, folks. I'm starting to lose my patience with entertaining this as even remotely serious. Annalise is in Broomall. Hi, Annalise. Thanks for your patience.
Hey, Chris, my husband and I really enjoy your show. Thanks for doing what you do.
Thank you for listening. Sincerely, I appreciate that.
Sure. So I've been very frustrated because I listen to talk radio, and there's those little segments you guys have in between where they say the news for the day. And when they talk about how Trump says mail-in voting is going to lead to fraud, they always follow it up with, and there's been no evidence to support this claim. And it's just been making me so angry that they can lie like that in what's supposed to be a news segment.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think that is? Is that do you think ultimately the goal is, and I'm asking rhetorically because I really don't have the answer, is the goal rhetorically to just get as many people as they can to invest their faith in mailing in a vote?
I think it's really just to lie. It's to further their narrative, like you were saying before, and it's been working because people believe it. They take it at face value. They don't question what they hear.
Or well, that's right. So, or is it, if Trump's going to win, we're going to make the country think for another 4 years he did it the same way he did it before he cheated. In other words, to just continue to sow discord, and if Trump should win, make sure the country, half the country, thinks he cheated and hates his guts just as much as he did before.
Yep, and then impeachment round number 17.
Yeah. That's sad, isn't it? It's just depressing that we can't move on and just let a winner be a winner and move on. But Annalise, thank you. Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you so much for listening. Let's go to Vinny in Wallingford. Hey, Vinny, good morning.
Hi. Hi, Chris. Everybody remembers when Trump said that he wanted to push the date back for the election, and everyone was freaking out. And even our fearless leader, Mitch McConnell, says you need an act of Congress to do that. Well, how come we don't need an act of Congress to change the way we vote? This is a national vote, not just one little podunk town.
Well, they will say that, you know, our representative republic, states can make their own rules and how they want to, you know, set up their elections, which technically is true. And that's how states end up getting away with, you know, like Phil Murphy just said, everybody in New Jersey gets a ballot. I mean, the only way that can ultimately be, it can be challenged in court and probably will be successfully, I doubt it. I mean, the Supreme Court has already basically said they don't intend to get involved in state elections. So these Democrats, look, Democrat Supreme Court, state Supreme Courts are going to matter a ton in the future. Pay attention to who's on your state Supreme Court, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland. That they matter. They're going to matter a lot going forward in terms of this mail-in vote business. Hey, Mike in Springfield. Hi.
Hey, Chris, I'm still an advocate. I'm in Pennsylvania. I requested 4 ballots in the family, and I received 4. I didn't get any for residents. I didn't get any from the previous owner. If you register, it will work.
Look, I know, I get it. Mike is singing the praises of mail-in. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying it's rife with fraud. There's no doubt about it. See you tomorrow.
WNTP Philadelphia. Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer. Download our free mobile app at 990theanswer.com.